Hi folks, Joe Stagner from Microsoft here. In this video, we're going to be touring a collection of the options that are available to help us troubleshoot our production ASP.NET IIS7 applications. Now, we're not going to be talking about troubleshooting in the debugging sense like we would do during the coding phase of the development lifecycle, so we're not going to use Visual Studio Debugger, or we're not going to write unit testing. We're also not going to be talking about the kinds of testing tools that we would use during the QA portion of our development lifecycle. Instead, what I'm going to be talking about in this video is troubleshooting those pesky defects that, despite our best efforts during software development, find their way into production. This has happened to all of us, and there are many reasons that these sorts of bugs make it all the way through the development lifecycle and into production. It might be because the bug only appears under extreme load conditions that we can't duplicate in our test environment. It might be because the bug only appears when there's a combinatorial effect between our application and some other application that's running in production. Or it might just be an infrastructure issue because it's too costly to exactly duplicate our production environment for testing. In any event, this has happened to all of us. There is the occasional bug that sneaks into production. And once a bug makes it into production, it can be extremely difficult to track down and solve that problem. So in this video, we're going to look at the variety of options that are available to help us with that sort of troubleshooting. And each one of the options that I'm going to touch on could be an entire video series in and of itself. So we're not going to go deep and drill down into any one particular option. Instead, I'd just like you to look at this as an inventory of options that are available to help you with this sort of troubleshooting. Now, before we get started, one thing I'd like you to remember is that the best way to facilitate production issue resolution is to instrument your applications at the code level. So add custom logic like custom logging, custom performance counters, a global unhandled exception handler that does proactive notifications to let you know that things are going wrong in your application. And in order to do that sort of code level instrumentation, there are a wide variety of great options that are provided for us by the Microsoft infrastructure. So the first one to think about is WMI. WMI stands for Windows Management Instrumentation. It's a complete set of COM objects, or if you're a .NET developer, you can use the system.management namespace and program against WMI. And WMI is a great way to find out what's actually going on in your entire technical environment when something happens. Of course, there's my personal favorite. It's called EIF, or the Enterprise Instrumentation Framework, that's produced by the really bright folks over the Patterns and Practices group. And EIF is a great way to instrument your enterprise application. Of course, there's ETW, stands for Event Tracing for Windows, and you can augment your application with .NET event tracing and logging through the functionality that are provided in the .NET framework rather than having to wire it all up from scratch. Then there's just standard ASP.NET tracing, which can be useful once you've sort of isolated the area that a bug might exist in. And lastly, there's the entire health monitoring infrastructure for ASP.NET 2.0, and that could be particularly useful as well, especially in large production environments. So there are all of these rich collection of options that help us build and run applications without defects in our production environment. But for the rest of this video, we're going to focus on the process of trying to resolve a defect that's made its way into production. And there are a wide variety of options to let us do that as well. So when it comes to troubleshooting, the first thing that I want to remind you is that Perfmon is your friend. So let's go ahead and run Perfmon. Now you can connect to Perfmon remotely. So you can run Perfmon on one machine and connect to the machine that you want to monitor, assuming that you have privileges to authenticate for that machine's connection. So one of the first things to check if something's going wrong on your site is to check the normal Perfmon resource views and see if anything's wildly out of whack. And you can see here I'm running on a moderately powered laptop, so just starting up Perfmon shows a bit of a bump in resource consumption. But this is a great place to start, and one of the things that I want to point out specifically, in addition to the standard resource monitors for the specific machine, there are a couple of things that you want to remember. One is that specifically in the performance monitor, you can add things that are specific to the web server, so and to .NET as well. So for example, I can find the web service here. I can drill down in, and I can pick specific things that I want to monitor. Right, so number of bytes in and out, that sort of thing. We could drill down into pretty low-level specifics in terms of figuring out exactly what's going on with our particular web server. So I just added basically all of the counters that are web server related for the computer that we happen to be monitoring. Another thing that is often overlooked is this reliability monitor that's in Perfmon, and this is an awesome resource. So if you if we grow this a little bit, if you look here, this gives us a timeline. So this gives us a timeline that goes back, right now it goes back a couple of weeks because I just recently built this machine. And look at some of the things that it tells us. So, for example, here's today, and this gives us information about what's happened on this machine today. Now, one of the reasons that this can be particularly useful is it tells you about all the updates that get installed. So if you find a problem that started happening on a particular day or at a particular point in time, you can go back and do a little forensic analysis to find out what changed on your machine about the same time that the problem appeared. And you notice here that as we look, we get different types of alerts here. So there are eyes. The white eye bubbles are just informational. The orange triangles with exclamation points, those are warnings. And then the red circles with X's are things that went profoundly wrong. So, for example, if I click on one of those, you can say, hey, this application actually stopped working on this date, and this is the version of the application. In this case, it happens to be the recorder that I'm using to record the screencast. So if you've got one of those on your web server, obviously there's probably something wrong. But it's great to know that you can find out an application stopped working, for example. Or if we go and look at the warning, there was a failure when installing the Windows Update Setup Handler. And I've had instances where somebody thought they installed something on their web server, only to later go and look at the reliability monitor and find out that install failed. So this is a super resource as well when you're starting to troubleshoot. Now, let's move into some of the more web-specific related troubleshooting techniques and technologies that are available. Of course, when it comes to troubleshooting, the IIS7 Manager doesn't leave us unsupported. So if we go into the IIS7 Manager, there are a couple items that we can take advantage of from a troubleshooting perspective. The first is, if we highlight the web server itself and look down in the IIS section, there's this item called Worker Processes. And if I double-click, what this will give us is a list of worker processes, what the process IDs are for the application pool, and a little bit of information about the resource consumption for that application pool. Now, in this case, this is my development machine, and I haven't made any requests to my web server for a while, so there are no processes currently running. If I go out to the desktop, I'm just going to run this command line script that will fire up a bunch of requests for web pages. And these web pages don't actually do anything. All they do is go into sleep and wait for a while to keep the process active. So if we hop back out and then go into worker processes again, what we see now is that the default app pool has applications that are running, gives us the process ID, tells us CPU utilization. Now, CPU utilization in our case is going to be zero because, as I mentioned, all of those pages, all they do is just go into sleep mode. So, but in a production environment, this is going to tell you exactly what the CPU utilization is for the app pool. And from a troubleshooting perspective, this can be really interesting. If you think you have an application that's causing some problems, you can spin it off into its own application pool and monitor that application pool. You can take that actually one step further and put limits on what resource consumption that particular application pool can consume, so it can be very useful. Also, you can see the private and virtual bytes. So this is a fair bit of information about what that particular process is consuming on our server, and especially if you segment applications to their own pools or collections of applications into their own application pool, this gives you an at-a-glance indication of what might be causing problems in terms of performance and reliability on your server. The other thing we want to note is if we go into the specific sites, and I scroll down a little bit, you'll find this item, IIS Reports. Now, you'll recall that IIS Reports is part of the admin pack that we downloaded from the IIS.net website. So this is one of the add-ins that's been created for us by the IIS team. But if we go into look at Reports, which you can see here, and this is what we can see here in one screenshot is a little bit restricted because of the screen resolution that I have to use for this video. But the interesting thing here is that this tells us traffic report, by default. So this will tell us if there's been some particular time period where we've had a profound spike in traffic. We might have gotten reports about performance problems and find out simply that there was a traffic spike. But if we drill down in, there's a lot of detail that's available for this report. So if we look here, which pages are the most popular, page status codes, response time taken, particular errors, or which HTTP verbs, and all of these can be really important tools in troubleshooting your application. For example, you know, if you're getting a bunch of HTTP verb requests that are not, you know, post or GET, for example, if those are the ones that your application uses, then you know, maybe we're under some sort of an attack. Referring site, for example, can tell us, is there a bunch of traffic coming from someplace that it shouldn't be coming from? Users accessed. Response time taken, in particular, can be interesting because we can look at the pages and see what their individual response times are and determine whether or not there's a specific page that has a longer than expected response time. Status codes, of course, tell us where errors are. So this IIS reports add-in from the administration pack that's available for download from IIS.net can be a profoundly useful tool in figuring out what's wrong with our website, whether it's from a reliability perspective or from a performance perspective. Of course, if you're running any magnitude of production applications on the Windows infrastructure, no discussion of troubleshooting would be complete without touching on WMI, or Windows Management Instrumentation. WMI is a rich set of technologies that enable consistent and uniform management, control, and monitoring of systems throughout your entire enterprise. And WMI is a complete science in and of itself. So the real details of WMI would be well beyond the scope of this particular video, but I just want to give you a quick look at WMI and see the kinds of things that you can do with WMI, and then leave it to you to drill deep into WMI and determine which parts or which ways of using WMI are most appropriate for your infrastructure. You can program against WMI either through managed code, directly against COM objects, or you can script against WMI objects. And scripting against WMI objects is very interesting because it lets you do sort of ad hoc work, very quick WMI scripting to evaluate what's going on in your infrastructure. So just by way of example, I have a WMI script here, and you notice here that I'm not going to walk through it in its entirety, but we'll notice that first we're just getting a reference to the WMI administration namespace, and then I'm going to get an instance of the worker processes, so the collection of worker processes, and then we're going to enumerate through those worker processes to see what's going on our server. Right? So let's go ahead and run this. I'm going to run it from a command line shell. And you notice now there are no worker processes in my web server because, again, I'm working here on my development machine, so I haven't fired any up. Let's just run that script that pops off a bunch of ASP.NET pages that basically don't do anything, but just to get some process consumption going on here on the website. And now, if we take a look at the output from that WMI script, we see there's a bunch of pretty interesting information here available to us. Tells us host name, the local IP address, the port it's running on, pipeline state, elapsed time. There's a whole collection of information. So the point here isn't for you to look at this quickie script and think that this is the extent of WMI. The point here is just to illustrate that WMI is one of the primary tools in your troubleshooting toolbox, and some detailed research into the capabilities of WMI and the preferred ways in your environment to program against the WMI functionality is really critical to building and running high-quality, reliable production applications in your ASP.NET, IIS7, and Windows environment. Another really incredible tool for our troubleshooting toolbox is AppCommand. The appcommand.exe file is a command line utility that exposes most of the server management functionality from IIS7. Now, as developers, we know that the best way to be able to troubleshoot an application is to thoroughly instrument that application at development time. But sometimes that's not possible. Either we have to choose to limit instrumentation in certain particularly resource-intensive portions of our application, or we just didn't think to instrument the area of the application that appears to be causing a particular problem. So there are times when we need to gather information for troubleshooting purposes at runtime and often in production, and AppCommand is a great way to do that. So if we take a look at this appcommand.exe command file. It's just a script file that I run that makes several calls to appcommand.exe to do things like list sites, list the application pools, and list current requests. Now, I want to be clear, this is far from all that you can do with appcommand. Appcommand is a rich set of technology, and if you would like some more information about the kinds of things that you can do with appcommand, go to the is.net website and search for appcommand.exe, and you'll get all kinds of information about how you can use appcommand. Again, this is just going to give you a quick, simple view at some of the kinds of things that you can do with appcommand and the way that you might use it. So let's go ahead and run this. Before I run it, the first thing I want to do is fire off that command script that creates a bunch of web page requests, and then I'm going to run that appcommand file. Just get this out of the way. Now what you see here is, as we expected, here are a list of the sites. So we have the default website and then Joe's site, which is a second web application that I created. A list of the application pools, the default app pool, the classic .NET app pool, and then the custom one that I created, Joe's site. And then you can see a couple of the requests to the sleep.asbx page, which was just that dummy page that I created that gets fired up to create some activity in the process and then just sleeps for a certain period of time. So you can see, really easy to use in a command file. You can also just use it manually in a command shell if you're doing some sort of dynamic on-the-fly troubleshooting. But again, appcommand.exe, a great tool to include in your troubleshooting toolbox. Another great tool in our troubleshooting toolbox is the failed request tracing technology that's built into IIS7 and the IIS Manager. Now, the interesting thing about failed request tracing is that you can turn it on or off, and you can get fairly granular about the kinds of requests that get traced. And this is especially useful when you're debugging one of those tricky problems in production that you haven't pre-instrumented for. Now, by and large, when everything is running fine in my web farm, I don't leave request tracing turned on because I don't want to incur the additional overhead of file I/O and disk space consumption and such. But when I'm trying to track down a particularly sticky bug that I can't do all of the troubleshooting in real time because I need the ability to gather and evaluate a collection of information to narrow down exactly what that problem is, failed request tracing is often the tool that I rely on to set up that information that I need to track down that bug. So if we look in the IIS7 manager and we go to our default website, if you look down in the IIS section, there's this item, failed request tracing rules. If I double click, the first thing that I want to do over in the Actions pane is select this Edit Site Tracing link and click on it. Notice here, this is where I enable fail request tracing and where I specify the directory that the output should be created in, the fail request log files. We also want to specify the maximum number of trace files that can be created. And this is something that, if you're having some difficulty in your web application, you want to be careful not to make this too large a number. If you know you're going to turn it on just for a very concise period of time, you have a lot of traffic on your website, you want to gather a bunch of data, but then you're going to turn it off, take those log files off, and do some forensic analysis to them afterwards, then you might set that to a large number. But by and large, if you're going to leave failed request tracing turned on in your production application, you want to make sure this maximum number of files is relatively low. I'm, of course, just going to go ahead and use the defaults, and then I'm going to, again, over in the Actions tab, I'm going to choose Add, and we're going to specify some content that we want to trace. Now, I can specify whether I want to turn this trace rule on for all content, just for ASP.NET files, or just for ASP files, or a custom one. So I could, you know, turn it on just for CSS files, right? Maybe, you know, I ran something like YSLO, and I've been told that CSS file resolution is causing some performance problems or what have you. So again, you can be pretty granular in terms of what kind of file you're tracing. In our case, I'm just going to turn tracing on for all content types and click Next. And here, we get to add some trace conditions. So we can specify status codes. So maybe I want to say I'm interested in 404s through 501s, and it's only status codes of in that range that I'm interested in generating a trace file for, or perhaps we're not getting errors. Maybe we're tracking down a problem in our site where the response codes are 200, so the page is successfully being served, but we're looking at some sort of, you know, tricky performance problem that we're trying to track down. So we're specifically going to trace 200 status codes. Another thing that we can set is the event severity. So we can say, hey, only critical warnings, or hey, we're interested in errors. We're doing some fine-tuning in our application. Or the amount of time taken in seconds for a particular page. So in our case, just so that we can run some demo pages and actually get some trace files to be created, I'm going to say generate a trace file for every request that takes more than 3 seconds, because I have a long-running request that I know will do that. So now I'm going to choose Next. Here you can see where we can choose the providers that we're interested in. So I can say I want to instrument the World Wide Web server provider. Specifically, we're interested in ISAPI extensions or ASP.NET or classic ASP even. And we can choose the level of verbosity. So we can say verbose, or specifically we're looking for, you know, informational entries, warnings, errors, etc. The other thing that we can do is choose the areas. So it might be, for example, that you know, maybe I'm doing some work with a CGI application and I'm specifically interested in trace files coming out of my CGI activities. In our case, again, just because we want to take a look at what one of these trace files look like, I'm going to leave them all on and choose Finish, and now I have this rule established. So in order to generate one of these files, I'm just going to run this command file that runs this long-running ASP.NET page, which will probably time out here, but that's okay, because we're going to go in and remember that we said this is where failed request trace files are going to be created, and I happen to have a link on my desktop to that location. So let's drill down there, and you can see here that we've created one of these failed request trace files. If I double click on it, and notice here that this .xml file is the one that was just created by IIS. This .xsl file is just the .xsl file that's used by Internet Explorer to present this failed request trace file in this nice, aesthetically pleasing and easy to navigate way. So this is the request summary, and this tells me that this was generated because of the amount of time taken, and the final status was 200, so it was successfully served. It just took longer than our threshold, the 3-second threshold that we specified. So you can see here actually the amount of time taken. Now, this is sort of the overview, as it says, request summary, but we can drill down into the details, and we can see how long each step in the pipeline took to execute. And again, as you can see here, this is a fairly rich interface, so I'm not going to drill down into each of the items that are available here. I just want you to know about fail request tracing so that you can start to configure your own trace requests and look at this report and understand enough about the report to be able to navigate it. So you can see things that are here, like ASP.NET specific page traces, custom module traces, authentication and authorization, which can be especially useful if you're trying to troubleshoot problems that appear for only authenticated or unauthenticated users. A performance-specific view. So hopefully this gives you an idea that this fail request tracing functionality is really rich, and the reporting mechanism makes it very easy for you to both at a glance and at the detailed level determine exactly what's going on with your web application in production. Of course, for page-specific troubleshooting, there's always ASP.NET tracing. One of the things to remember about turning on ASP.NET tracing is that you can specify at the page level whether or not the trace should be local only, meaning you actually have to be browsing to the site from the server that it's running on, or whether the trace information will be visible remotely. And you want to be very, very careful about making the trace information visible remotely, because that trace information can be very useful for folks that are gathering information to conduct some malicious conduct against your website. So just by way of example, here I have a site, and this site basically opens up a database and pulls some information out of it, and it lists that information in a web form. And I have a command file that will run that. Let's go ahead and run it. Before I do, though, you'll note that I've got debugging set right now to false. So we'll just see what happens normally. And I'll do that by running a command file that deploys and executes that. You can see we just got to have a data grid here. I'm going to turn on tracing. So let's go ahead and in our editor go ahead and change trace from false to true. Save, and then run my script that will redeploy that file. And now you can see there's this great collection of all kinds of information that's available to us. Now, one of the interesting things here is that this information, and we'll drill down and you can see all of the detailed specifics about the controls that are used on the page, what actions are taking place. It's extremely detailed information. But one of the more important things to remember is that in my code, I have a couple of interesting code level additions. One is this trace.warn, and the other is down here trace.write. So trace.warn says starting the data grid code, and trace.write says end of the data grid code. And this is especially useful. I know I've got a problem with a particular bit of my code, but I'm not sure about the sequence in which things are happening. I could turn this on, and then when trace is enabled, these items are output in that trace data on my page. So if we go back in and take a more of a detailed look, you'll note here that here is the application specific trace data. So you remember those two statements, starting data grid code, end of data grid code, and here they appear in the trace data for my page. Now the thing to remember is that notice that starting data grid code is in red, and that's because in our code, we use trace.warn. If we just output with trace.write, then we don't get that red highlighting. So it's a little bit of a different priority in terms of the messaging. Now, one of the things that might be interesting is if we have local tracing on, but we want to collect information over a period of time, it's not something that we can immediately diagnose. What we can do is turn tracing on with local only enabled so that users that are browsing to our web application won't see the trace output, but the trace output will be generated. And again, you want to be careful because you want to do this only while you're debugging, because obviously the generation of this trace information in your production environment causes an increase in resource consumption, etc. So you do this while you're troubleshooting, not sort of as your standard operating procedures. But in this case, the scenario we're painting is that we've turned tracing on and we've enabled local only so that the tracing engine is activated, but the tracing information isn't viewable from any old browser that just happens to come to this website. And the next thing that I want to do is I'm going to go back into our friend the IS7 manager, and at the server level I'm going to add a request rule, and what you'll see here is I'm setting a trace condition for all 200 level pages. So again, be very, very careful please about doing this in production. I'm doing this for a very fixed period of time to do some specific troubleshooting. I'm setting a trace condition for 200 status code, which means that I'm interested in seeing the trace information for pages that are successfully generated by my application. Right, so I'm going to go ahead and leave all of that enabled. And now I'm going to go and run this one more time just to make sure that the tracing information gets generated. Right? And as we look down here, we can see this, the specific trace output from our application code. But remember that we're talking now about the scenario where I'm not necessarily going to be able to look at this code for each page request. And the problem here, of course, is that there's some user scenario that's causing some difficulty, so I can't duplicate it myself at the keyboard, but I want to be able to look at this this application-specific trace information that's generated by my production application when a user navigates to this employees.aspx page. So now that I've added this failed request tracing rule for 200 status codes, now I can go back into my directory where I specified that the trace log files should be created. And you'll notice that I've created a few here. If I double click on any one of these, the first thing you'll notice down here is that in errors and warnings, we have this section here. And this is generated by our custom code. Now, if we drill down in, we can see exactly where this warning came from, and we can see that it's the employees.aspx file, and the event data, meaning the textual argument that we passed to the write method, was starting data grid code. So the interesting thing about this, again, just from a scenario perspective, is that I can enable this, making sure that remote viewing of the trace data is turned off, and then after a few minutes in production, I can go in and look at these trace files to see what's happening that is being generated by the end user's use of my application, rather than trying to duplicate it myself here in my own environment. So hopefully there's a whole collection of really interesting and powerful troubleshooting tools that are available to you to try and troubleshoot your applications in real time. In addition to the MSDN site, I encourage you to go to the IIS.net site, which is packed with information about how to run a production IIS-based infrastructure, as well as the ASP.net site, which has a lot of great learning and tutorials, video tutorials, written tutorials, etc., around building reliable ASP.net applications. ¶¶